Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
The main purpose of this show, I'll give you the rundown, two things. In the first half hour of the show, we're going to talk with the author of a book called Jobs That Matter, Finding a Stable is a good word these days, Fulfilling Career in Public Service. Also, we will make sure we allow plenty of time for you to call in for a three-minute career makeover if you or someone you love could use some career help. Certainly the price is right, zero. But I was, as I often do, as I'm making my final preparations for the show, I also do listen to the previous show here on KELW, which is Philosophy Talk. And their topic was wisdom. What is it? Can you acquire it? Etc. And so I was sitting there musing and had some thoughts about it, and I thought I would share them with you just because it's clearly relevant to one's work life as well as just one's overall existence on this earth. There are, of course, many definitions of wisdom, but one that I kind of like is this. A wise person is a person who has the circumspection to transcend the common ethos of the era. I'll explain what that means. It's a lot of big words. We tend to be sucked in by the conventional wisdom of our particular slice in history. What's currently the conventional wisdom in 2011 in intellectual America. But this is merely a blink in the eye of the millennia of history. And the ability to transcend the transient and instead think in terms of the most cosmic good. What if one pulled aside the shackles of current conventional wisdom? What is the thinking that would most yield the greatest good for the greatest number without imposing cosmically unethical harms to individuals? To me, that would be my definition of what wisdom is, for what it's worth. Anyway, on to a more mundane yet more practical topics, and important especially in these unprecedentedly difficult job times. Many people, especially here in the Bay Area that has such liberal sensibilities, is caught between the enormous conflict, that, or at least apparent conflict, between on the one hand needing to make a living in these tough times and wanting to keep to your, what I'm calling, Bay Area values. And those are normally defined as, how can I work for the government or a nonprofit? How can I avoid a corporation, working for a corporation, and still make a decent living and not be just one of those millions of people who are, you know, getting to work for a nonprofit because the cause is so great they expect you to work for a volunteer for no wages or $10 an hour. And, you know, it used to be that the government, especially the federal government, was the bastion of opportunity for such people because they're not as really accountable to the bottom line. They can always print more money. They can increase the deficit. You know, they could pay very good wages with amazing benefits and lots of time off and not having to work 70 hours a week. But even that's changing because the budget has become so, our deficit has become so enormous that we are indeed in danger of being taken over by China because China owns half our debt and our credit rating is down. So even the government, which tends to metastasize into ever greater size, is at least in the short term forced to pull on some measure of ropes of restraint so that that the budget doesn't get any scarier, the deficit doesn't get any scarier. So federal jobs are no longer as plentiful as they have been. What's a liberal to do? Or anybody who doesn't want to work for a company, for a for-profit? Are there really any jobs? Are there pockets of opportunities? Are there rewarding jobs in the nonprofit and government sector that are actually available and pay a middle-class salary? How do you find one in these unprecedentedly tight times? Well, I've got someone here to help us. Her name is Heather Krasna. She is the Director of Career Services at the Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington, and she's helped hundreds of people find jobs and internships in government and nonprofits, even in recent times. And she has distilled what she's learned in a book that I would most, if there was an adjective I'd use to describe it best, it's generous. It was a ton of work. I could just see how much research she had to do. She's assembled a whole lot of lists of descriptions of all kinds of careers in the nonprofit and government sector under the radar. She's interviewed a bunch of people and told their stories and have lessons learned. The book is called Jobs That Matter: Find a Stable, Fulfilling Career in Public Service. And she even finds time to play the ukulele. Heather Krasner, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for inviting me to be on your show.
My pleasure. So, whet our appetite. What are some interesting, under-the-radar public service careers?
Sure. When I wrote this book, I was the first person to try to include both nonprofit and government into one book. Usually there were, you know, make a difference in the world, get a nonprofit job, or get a nice, stable, nicely paid government job. But I found that government jobs can also be just as fulfilling and make a difference. Nonprofit jobs can also be stable, so I got together one book. And there's more to it than you would ever imagine. Some of the jobs that people don't necessarily think of could be, for example, in government, there's a pretty large role for acquisitions, contracting, and auditing, all the financial and businessy type of jobs, mm-hmm. but within the government setting. These days, there's a big push towards disaster preparedness, mm-hmm. Outreach and education to prepare people for disasters. There's also a really big need for cybersecurity. So mm-hmm. if people are great with computers mm-hmm. and know about security, that's a pretty big need right now.
Mm-hmm.
And in the nonprofit world, there's always a need for people who can do fundraising, mm-hmm. who can do public relations, communications, and also a big need for finance there, too. And then because of some of our, you know, current events that are going on in the federal government in particular, they're looking for people who speak Arabic and certain other languages that are a little hard to come by, like Dari, Farsi, and Urdu. So if you have any of those special skills, it's great to think about jobs in government or nonprofit because they're in demand.
That makes great sense. That's a wonderful list. Of course, the magic. Well, first of all, you know, and I can't imagine there are many people who listen to this show who are saying, "Ooh, I'm excited about the idea of being in having career in acquisitions, contracting, and auditing." It's what you mentioned first. And, you know, from my having looked at USAjobs.gov, indeed, there are a lot of jobs like that, contract administration, program analyst, all those kind of jobs. Are they, even if you're working for the government, the greater good, in, you know, or a nonprofit, are those jobs boring and yucky and you forget the fact that you're losing for the working for a good cause, but instead you're mired in a bunch of paperwork? Do you have any idea?
It depends so much on the job and what exactly they're doing, but I know that the job titles, unfortunately, don't always tell you anything about the job. So the title program analyst is completely vague. You have no idea what that really means.
And it's a big job.
But that job can be really exciting. I've had people who worked as a program analyst for Housing and Urban Development, the federal agency, and they're organizing a sustainability initiative to make sure that investments in new housing are, you know, well located towards transit so that people can have less of a carbon footprint in their housing investment. Stuff like that has a really huge impact. And so if you look at it that way and make sure you're looking at what is the agency really doing and how is it making a difference, those jobs can be very rewarding, and it's not all paperwork at all. It's a lot of outreach to the public, working with other agencies, working with nonprofits, bringing people in so that you get their opinion on how things should work, making sure you're using the taxpayer dollars very, very wisely. All of that is very fulfilling. So unfortunately, the titles are very they don't sound fulfilling, but they can be.
So sounds great. Depends. That's a good answer. Now, I want to, in yet another example of my admitting my ignorance, you ticked off a bunch of languages, which I had, you know, one of which I had never heard of. What's Dari?
Dari is a language spoken in, I'm going to probably not get the exact geography correctly, but it's one of the languages that I believe is in Afghanistan and Pakistan, a couple of areas that are, you know, hot spots in the world for what our government is up to. And so people need language translators for some of those languages in particular.
Not just language, but culture. You know, a number of the languages you talked about, and this really speaks to the world of where the focus of the world has been and has become. If you look in today's New York Times or any newspaper, you will see that a tremendous amount of the challenges we're facing in the world are focused on the Middle East. So when you mentioned Arabic and Dari and Farsi and Urdu, these are all Middle Eastern languages. So, you know, one takeaway, whether you want to work for a for-profit, nonprofit, or government agency, the world has changed. you know, you can call it Arab Spring, you can call it Arab Autumn, whatever you want to call it, but things are changing. And if you are having a having some discretion about where you want to become expert, not just in the language, because it's certainly hard as an adult to become to learn Dari as an adult, but becoming a culture specialist, becoming an expert in, for example, any one country. You know, and it's not you can't. We live in an era of hyper specialization, so it's not even enough for you to say I want to become an expert in Syria. If you want to become an expert in the socio-political religious interface in Syria, that's the kind of thing that could get you hired by the government, by a nonprofit, and even a for-profit that's trying to do business in that area. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay. Let's turn to stories. Stories are always wonderful. Lists are great. We've given a wonderful list of some career public service careers that are on the upswing. But your book is peppered with stories of people in interesting public service careers. What's a particularly instructive such story?
So one of the ones I think is interesting, I like to think about transitions. A lot of the people who are in the book kind of already knew when they were growing up that they were very excited by one particular mission area, and so their whole career is in that area. So, you know, that makes sense if that's what you knew you wanted, but lots of people don't know what they want, and they mm-hmm. make a change in the middle of their life. So right. one of the examples is a woman named Carol Dunn, who lives in the Seattle area. She had a lot of international experience and had lived in Kazakhstan and a bunch of areas in the sort of Central Asia, and she traveled a lot. Then she got married, moved back to the U.S., and had some kids and wanted a job where she didn't have to travel the world as much, and so she started volunteering for the Red Cross. And she used her language skills, which include Russian, and was a translator explaining and reaching out to the community that speaks Russian about how to be prepared for an earthquake or a flood or whatever. And, you know, she was volunteering, and then she realized, you know, I actually, if I can explain this in Russian, I should be able to do it in English, too. And so she actually got hired on by the Red Cross as a disaster management educator. And then after a while, she switched gears, and now she works for local government doing the same kind of work, helping people be prepared for disasters and emergencies, and she works in one of the local cities around the Seattle area. So she made that transition a very broad transition from being a foreign relations kind of international development person to being a disaster management educator for a local government. So that's a big transition, but she did it through volunteering, and that's a story that's a theme throughout this book, is that several people made a switch from one thing to another because they volunteered.
Yep. One of the great challenges, you know, we all know that volunteering is a way to potentially transition into a new career, but it's the great catch 22. So many people need to make a living, and do they have time to volunteer more than a few hours a week in a place? It's hard. And then they also know it's kind of roulette. No matter how much you schmooze and network with the higher-ups in the nonprofit, for every 20 volunteers, maybe one gets hired, so the odds are not that great. So the volunteer thing is scary. Do you have any advice about that dilemma?
Well, it's true that you can't pretend that it's going to absolutely turn into a job. It's not guaranteed to turn into anything. But if you're strategic about it, it can be beneficial. It's going to, so for lots of people who are switching from corporate to nonprofit, having some of that nonprofit experience can be so important that you might even put it first on your resume before you get into your corporate work experience. That's how you can do that transition. So I would say there's different kinds of volunteering. So be strategic. There's board of directors type of work where you're involved with governance. There's
Let me stop you there. That's very important. Dear listeners, most people think that getting onto a board of directors means you need to be worth $10 million and have a tremendous resume. That's true only for the large organizations. Small organizations are always looking for board members, and it's a great way to have really good ongoing contact with influential people, and I agree with Heather completely. Continue.
Thank you. Yeah, so small to mid-sized nonprofits, they may want a working board, meaning that if you're an accountant and you can volunteer mm-hmm. some of your financial expertise, they mm-hmm. would love to have you on a board or whatever. So, but think about it as, where are you going to gain some new skills that are relevant to the new career that you want to get into, mm-hmm. and where are you going to build networking connections, and how will it improve your resume? So think of it strategically, and then you can, you know, you don't have to spend 90 hours a week on this. You know, you can do just a few hours. They know you're a volunteer. So focus on opportunities where you're going to learn a new skill. And, you know, maybe you're not ready to be on a board, but you want to gain a particular technical skill. So let's say in fundraising, you need to learn Razor's Edge or another database that's used to keep track of donors. Well, there's tons of nonprofits that could use you to come in and just do a little data entry, and now you can put Razor's Edge on your resume or grant writing, whatever it might be, which is an in-demand skill for a certain kind of career. So just do it strategically. And there's lots of places to find these volunteer opportunities. You can go to idealist.org, which is one of the best websites for nonprofit, and that's IDEALIST.org. And there's tons and tons of other sites that you can use to find these types of volunteer opportunities.
Excellent. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Heather Krasner. She is the author of Jobs That Matter, Find a Stable, Fulfilling Career in Public Service. That is both in the nonprofit sector as well as government sector. Tell me another story. Tell me another, that wonderful, that was a great story because it really highlighted the importance of the internship as a potential launch pad for a career. Tell us another story that might be instructive.
Sure. Within government in particular, there's two very, there's tons of layers within it and so on. But people think of government, often they think about elected office and elected officials. I mean, most jobs, the vast majority of government jobs, are not going to be working with a political party or elected official, but within an agency doing a program or doing something, you know, that's more sort of delivering a service or that sort of thing. But I do have one person in my book who worked with elected officials. Her name is Jill Lane. She's now a professor of political science and at a community college. But for a while, she worked with elected officials, and she basically did those careers really require a lot of networking and a lot of very fast-paced outreach. And I think one of the things that she had done, and which lots of people do, is she moved to Washington, D.C. because she wanted to work on the national level, but you could do this on a local level also. And she volunteered with campaigns, and she worked jobs where she could, you know, day jobs where she could pay the bills, and then she just did unpaid jobs at the same time. She just worked very, very hard to get her foot in the door until she could be hired for a paid position working with elected officials. And this is a way that if you're very driven to see major policy change happen and be part of that, you know, you can be working with an elected official whose positions you agree with or care about. And so she worked for a while doing all sorts of initiatives and efforts with different elected officials in Washington, D.C., and then she switched gears, and now she's teaching about that same process as a professor. So that's another kind of a story of kind of volunteering your way to a job until you get hired, and you know, with the position she was looking for with elected office, that was the way to go, is through networking and through getting yourself out there and being in the mix where the decisions were being made. So that's another example.
Yep. You said something very interesting. You said because she was very driven and she was willing to work really super hard. Here is the really, this is the one of my problems with self-help books, and I've written them myself. But there is this general tendency to generalize from the extraordinary person to everybody. In other words, these are what, you know, these are extraordinary people have done these extraordinary things. But in the real world, as you well know, working at the university, there is not everybody is driven. Not everybody is brilliant. Not everybody is a great networker. There are, you know, by definition, there are as many people below average as there are above average in intelligence, in drive, in personality, in looks, which unfortunately matters a lot in this world. What advice do you have to the, let's not even make it easy, we're not going to make it the below average person, but the person with average intelligence, average drive, average looks, average networking skills, who would like to work in the nonprofit or government sector?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that if you decide what you really want to do and you focus on that, then, you know, the position, some of the jobs that are out there in nonprofit and government are very competitive. It depends on the sector. Certain jobs are kind of the most prestigious or the hottest or whatever. So things that are, you know, international development or you know, becoming a foreign service officer for the State Department, that requires somebody who is fairly above average in terms of learning foreign languages and being able to pass really difficult exams and all sorts of stuff. So I would say, you know, think about the jobs that are much more common and also much more in, maybe even more in demand, that are here in the U.S. and that are very much needed. So what are some things that are growing where they really need people? You know, certainly security is a big one. I've had folks do sort of more the frontline customer service work that has to happen with any agency. So people who've gone to work with for the Social Security Administration, where they're basically answering calls from people all day about how to get their benefits or why did they get denied their benefits. And that job, you know, you may not think it's super fulfilling, but it can be, because you're helping people on a daily basis to make ends meet financially, and you're listening to them. And, you know, if you're really a people person, a job like that could be great. You don't have to be a superstar to get those kinds of jobs all the time. I mean, they need people on a regular basis, and so you can get your foot in the door. And look at positions where there really is a big demand and a big need, and you don't have to be the rocket scientist to get the job. You know, like in nonprofit, if you can learn to do grant writing or fundraising, these are things that people can learn to do. And if it matches your personality, that's an excellent way to get into a nonprofit. So you really don't have to, you know, have the best grades or be the, you know, someone who can work 90 hours a week. You really don't. I mean, there's plenty of opportunities to get in if you think very broadly about opportunities that you're interested in.
I need a little more reassurance. I've had clients who are, you know, not below average, but kind of average folks, who've applied for jobs like program analyst, or jobs, certainly the $10 an hour jobs you can get. But if you're trying to make even a bare middle class living, and they're applying for jobs in the government and nonprofit sectors, you talked about fundraising, even at fairly low levels, if they're going to pay even $35,000 a year, which is just bare survival, you know, living here in the Bay Area, certainly, mm-hmm. they're getting dozens, if not hundreds, of applicants. Is your experience different than that?
Well, that's going to be true of a lot of entry-level positions, but if you start to look more, you have to get strategic in the search process. And so one of the things that anybody can do, you don't have to be a superstar to do this, but you have to get yourself to do it, is start to make connections and do networking. And of course, you've probably given this advice to everybody hundreds of times.
Makes me vomit, the word networking. What about, well, the problem is that the people who are good networkers, they know they need to network and they do it. The problem is that many people are not good networkers. They're shy, or they are ugly, and I hate the look of them in this society, but if you are fat, or you are old, or you are ugly, you have two strikes against you. So people, there are many, many people, especially those who come for career help, who are not good networkers. What advice do you have for people who are not good networkers?
Well, I think there's actually plenty of extroverted jobs and plenty of introverted jobs in the government in particular. So for instance, if somebody's not the most social, most outgoing person, you know, then, you know, maybe look for positions where that's not part of the requirement of the job, and therefore it's not that you're exempted from having to do networking, but you can, the people that you're going to be networking with are not going to be schmoozy either, because that's just not part of the job. So I think of plenty of people I've met who do, again, like the auditing or the mm-hmm. more administrative behind the scenes work mm-hmm. where, you know, they're really not extroverted, and they would be turned off by somebody who comes in like gangbusters and is sort of aggressive in their networking. So I would look for positions that match that person's personality. If somebody is not super extroverted, there's tons of jobs like that where you're doing more analytical work, or you're doing more of the administration. And, you know, I've actually organized plenty of networking events for people at my school, and there was an example I can think of where someone came from an auditor's office and she needed a new auditor. And she was at this networking event, and she was the person doing the hiring, and you would hope that she would, you know, kind of outreach and get people to come talk to her at this event so she could hire them. But she was really shy. She was an auditor. She didn't like talking in big groups. And so I actually took it on myself to find the other, you know, candidates who I knew would be good at this job, and, you know, grab them and bring them very quietly over to this woman in the corner and say, hey, would you two start talking to each other? She's really interested in this job, and I know you're looking for somebody with that background. Maybe the two of you could find a quiet area and go talk. So it worked out great. You know, it's just that, you know, people who are a little more introverted, they can still do these connections. I think the world has made it much easier to do this because now you have LinkedIn.com where you can reach out more individually. You don't have to go to big schmoozy events all the time, and you can be successful making connections, even if it goes against your personality, because you can do it a little bit more on the one-to-one basis and reach out to people online. And I want to share another site, which I think is really excellent for people wanting to get into government, which is called govloop.com, and that's govloop.com. And that's basically like Facebook, but for government. Most of the people in there already work in government, but there are people wanting to get in who can join. And I've found people to be very open about answering questions and even just connecting individually with someone on there where they might not do it on another site. So I would say, you know, somebody who's a little shy, try something that isn't as well known, but would let you get out there and start to make some contacts, and eventually you'll be, you know, successful. It just can take a little time, but it's very possible.
Great suggestion. You know, I've noticed that every single one of the examples you've given, even in the abstract, have been a woman. Today, the unemployment rate for men is 20% higher than women. And in your experience, have you been seeing any differences in terms of the way, you know, in regard to gender in the job search today?
That's a great question. I mean, I'll be honest, the School of Public Administration often has more women than men because, and actually the nonprofit sector, just so people know, in general is more female dominated. Government is, I think, more evenly distributed, and depending on the agency, if it's more like a police or fire or security type of agency, is going to skew more towards men, actually, as you might guess. But nonprofit, not to generalize because there's so many millions of nonprofits out there, but it, as a sector, tends to gear towards women. So maybe that's why, you know, some of the people I'm bringing up are women. But you know, I don't think that I haven't seen there be a challenge necessarily for men getting positions. I think it just depends on, again, each person's background and what they're looking for. So, you know.
Okay. You know. We're just about out of time, but I have two questions I want to ask you. One is, we've focused so much, you know, if I'm looking at the arc of this interview, most of the jobs we were talking about, we've disproportionately focused on the government sector. So I want to make sure that we gave you a shot at the nonprofit. Is there any, and I know you talked about fundraising, but is there, and grant writing, but is there any other kind of an under-the-radar nonprofit career that is in this job market experiencing growth?
You know, I think that, like I said, fundraising is always the sort of mainstay. However, I've started to see some new positions open up, which are usually they're part of the communications department, and the title is something like digital media strategist or social media strategist.
Right.
And these are jobs that, you know, may not pay a ton, and they tend to hire younger folks who are really savvy with social media. But if someone's really interested in social media, then that's a new and emerging type of field for nonprofits, because they're discovering they can get a lot of donations if they allow them to be given through, you know, a text message, or if people join their Facebook page and like them and so on, they get more engagement with the community. And so that's becoming a new career field. So I think that's an emerging.
Yeah, I can see that, of course. You know, one wonders, I think I'm cautiously optimistic that social media is not going to be a fad, because I do think that especially women who tend to be more social, they trust each other in terms of making buying decisions, and this whole thing about my friend recommended this, my friend did that. I think that it's a very new female-centric world that Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn are all, because it's all about that networking that women tend to do better than men. Does that make sense?
But I think that I also know very, I want to say a little bit nerdy guys who are really great with computers that are excellent at social media. I shouldn't say nerdy, but I think of that as a positive anyway.
Sure.
That's a plus. So I think it's an equal opportunity thing. But I do think it's definitely, it's here to stay. So those are careers that are starting up, basically.
Well, last question. A decade ago, you were a career coach, you know, not in the university, but you focused on creatives, artists, actors, musicians, writers. What, if anything, that you want to share that's not obvious that you'd like to share with us what you learned from that experience?
Well, I loved doing that, and I still do that. I do a little freelance work, and I find that folks who are creative and artistic have, you know, they just come up with creative solutions to challenges. So one of the things I saw was people who came up with these ways of making a living that were really unusual. So I had people who, I had a guy who was a an investment banker who would save up all the money he made as a banker for a year. He would do it every other year, basically make all this money, and then he would save all the money, and he would quit his job and become a professional saxophone player, and he would play jazz and tour around the country playing jazz. And he'd use up his money, and then he'd go back to banking again. So stuff like that I found fascinating, and really, you know, it just expands your view of what can work as a career and what can work as a way of putting a living together. And I learned a lot from that in terms of people balancing ways of making income with ways of being fulfilled creatively. And I found that, you know, it could be a challenge and it could be easy. It could be difficult, but it worked out really well for people.
Yeah, a little follow up with that. Just a couple days ago, I did a demonstration about how to be a good radio talk show host, essentially TV talk show host, at the San Francisco Academy of Art, where they have this program for training people to be TV anchors and TV news people. And, you know, without saying too much, I left there depressed because I felt like they were, in a sense, they were like playing with cameras and playing with microphones. But, you know, I know how difficult that whole job market is. And so they have this, they're going to graduate, if they graduate, with this enormous amount of debt. They're paying a fortune to do this. And they were, you know, and that made me flashback on the countless clients I have who would love to be artists or writers or singers or comedians or musicians or magicians or whatever.
Right.
Having had, you know, worked with 50 of those people a decade ago, what advice do you have for the millions of people who would love to make a living from their art, but they're not going to be in the Bolshoi Ballet? They're not the one in a zillion, or they don't, you know, what advice do you have to those folks?
Well, there's some great books out there that I think are really, one of them is called The Career Guide for Creative and Unconventional People. I really like that book. But basically the idea is, there's so many ways of making this happen, and, you know, not everyone defines themselves by the way they make money, and our culture tends to really focus on that in terms of the way that you're making money is how you're defined. And I find lots of people define themselves some other way, whether they're earning money through some job that they may or may not love every single day, but that job may free up their mind. It may not be the most exciting, challenging job, but it frees their mind so that on the weekend they can be a musician, or they can, you know, they find some way to have a part-time job and spend the rest of their time doing something that fulfills them creatively. So I think it's, and then there's people who use their creative way of, they have a job that does use their creativity, even if it's not the musician way. So, for example, me, I mean, I love doing creative career counseling with people and helping them rewrite their resumes and figure out what they want to do with their lives. It's very creative. It's a really creative process. You know, I'm also a musician, and I do that when I have some time, you know, but I don't regret deciding to be a career counselor, even though, you know, I'm also a musician, too. So, you know, finding a way to be fulfilled, use your creativity, and also make a living. It's possible, you know. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to, you know, necessarily get the day job that you hate and then, you know, try to make it as an artist. And if you don't make enough money as an artist, then you haven't made it. I don't buy that at all. I think you can be very successful as an artist and not make any money at it. I really think those two things don't have to be the same. That's just what I've seen.
I agree. I've had a lot of fun, for example, playing the piano. I have made a living at it when I was younger, but now just for fun, or acting in plays or directing plays. I don't make a dime, but it really felt during that period of my life like a big part of my identity, and worth it even if I didn't make a dime. That defines success without non-monetary terms. So on that point of agreement, and we had many, I want to thank you, Heather, for being a part of Work with Marty Nemko this Sunday.
Thank you so much.
And her book is Jobs That Matter, Find a Stable, Fulfilling Career in Public Service. Very good book. As I said, generous book, worth getting. Okay, and now, my dear listeners, I want to turn to you. As always, one of the core missions of this show is to help you individually. It's all well and good to interview guests about, you know, what might do in theory, or big picture issues, but I also care to get to the ground level, and that helps me be grounded, helps the show be grounded, and not just airy-fairy, pie-in-the-sky stuff. So Call me with your real-world career problem, and I will do my very best to help you and help give you a baby step toward the right direction. Sometimes it's a practical solution. Sometimes it's a psychological solution. I had dinner last night. I'm going to do my best I can to hide everything about this person's background, but still give you the essence of it. I had dinner with this person last night, my wife and Barbara and I did, and she said that she's just confused. She's in her 40s. And she's feeling like she can't stay focused. She's well-trained in a career, but she can't make herself focus. She's getting swallowed up by day-to-day tasks. She hasn't really worked in a while. She would like to. She knows she'd like to. And even when we discuss ideas, she knows she should do X, Y, and Z, but she can't quite make herself do it. And so we talked a little bit about the psychological things that may be getting in the way. There's so many. It's a combination of psychological, time management, you know, fear that she's not competent enough to do it, confident enough to do it. So those are kind of sometimes solutions that are not just about coming up with a career idea for you. So if you're stuck, I invite you to call for what I call 3-Minute Career Makeover, and we will try to get you unstuck, whether it's practically or psychologically. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, I will share with you some tips, which I just so love to do. When I was a kid, I commentated basketball games while I was playing. I'd be going playing, and sometimes, believe it or not, I love playing basketball so much, I played in the snow. I was back in New York, and so you couldn't even dribble the ball, but there I was. And I would pretend, you know, I would pretend I was the New York Knicks. It was back, you know, this is Walt Frazier bringing it in the forecourt along the left side, passes it inside to the Busher, out to Willis Reed for a jump shot. Yes. Okay, so that, the fact that I did that under no pressure from anybody, it was anomalous. It was something different. The fact that I would do that offers a clue as to who I am. It said that I like the idea of speaking out in front of people. I liked showing off. That is those kind of things that are unusual that you did in your childhood before society kind of imposed its strictures on what you could do, what you should do, etc., can often offer a clue to you. So take a moment right now, for the fun of it, even if you're not looking for a new career. Think back to something that you enjoyed doing as a child that was anomalous, that wasn't what every other kid wanted to do. And ask yourself, does that offer a clue, a tip, to something you might want to do career-wise? Something you might want to do avocationally? Just a thought. I will give out the phone number again, by the way. If you or someone you love has a career problem, you still don't know what you want to be when you grow up, even though you're already supposed to be grown up. You know you should be doing X, Y, or Z work-wise, and you can't motivate yourself to do it. You are self-employed and are struggling, or you're wondering whether you should be self-employed. You have an idea, but you wouldn't mind getting a few suggestions on how to tweak it to make it better so it's a lower risk and or higher profitability, or whether you should do it at all. Pitch your idea to me. I will give you my thumbs up or thumbs down, let you know if I'd invest in it or not. The phone number for all those reasons, and the umbrella term for that is what I call a 3-minute career makeover. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Another little tip. Very often, one of the best things you could say to either your boss, or if you're in a job interview and you're talking to the boss or getting interviewed by the boss, to say something like, I'm eager to not just improve myself, but I'm eager to help you, my boss. How could I help you get a gold star or a top-rated review on your salary review or your evaluation next year? That shows a lack of egotism. It helps you, especially if you're a job interview, to find out what's really important to that boss. It's a gold mine question. I'll say it again. It's a really good one. How might I help you get a top evaluation in your next performance review? So that's my thought. All right. Now I guess it's time to go to the phones. Let's go to the phones and welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air.
All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. How can I help?
I am by heart a writer.
Uh-huh.
And
me too.
I want to do more of it. In a day job. I'm not really, I'm okay with it, but my passion and my heart is in writing.
Right. And let's talk about that. What kind of writing are you? Would you, if you could do any kind of writing that would most feed your soul, what would it be?
I write from a spiritual standpoint. I actually bring in a spirit guide, and which is my grandmother, and I just let it flow. It's like it's what I think Dr. Wayne Dyer called automatic writing, where you just go to your computer and you let it rip.
Okay. So which of the following feels like the best kind of vehicle for your writing? Should you write a blog? Should you write a book of poems? Should you self-publish a book of your spiritual writing? Should you write speeches for spiritual leaders or homilies? Which of those, if any, feel like who you are?
Wow. Well, there's a combination because I'm a motivational speaker as well.
Okay.
I have my own side business besides my day job.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a novel, and I actually incorporated my poetry in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of all over the map there.
So are you already doing so? You're doing the writing. You're writing a novel. So is the question more how to move that novel forward into final status so you're feeling good about it and you put it out to the world? Is that correct or is that incorrect?
Correct.
Okay, great. So how far along are you in the novel, and are you stuck or is it just a matter you're in progress?
Matter of progress. I'm about a third way through, but it's so in my mind. It's just ridiculous. Like, it's there.
Okay, so is it a matter you're not able to this point to have put aside enough time to finish it? Or is it
correct.
More that you need? Time. So
time.
If you were to look at your time right now, are there things you spend time on that are lower priority than this book? For example, watching television, listening to your friend complain for the 97th time, maybe even reducing the amount of time you spend with friends or family?
There is time to do it. It's just a matter of, stopping the procrastination and just getting it done.
What do you think is making you procrastinate?
It's weird things like, I want things organized before I meditate. I want things organized before I write. Like my desk has to be clear, kind of that OCD almost.
Mm-hmm. And is that something we need to accept about you, or is that something you think you could change?
I think I like to accept it because when I really want to do something, in order to get it done, I have to that I haven't done.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Some people are motivated additionally by being part of a writer's group. If you were, and writers groups meet like every week and they each read they read a page of what they've written to their fellow group members, to get feedback, and also kind of keeps them accountable on progress. Is that something you either have done or think would help you or not really?
I've done it. Didn't particularly like it.
Okay. Was that because of the group or the particular people?
It could have been a combination of both, because the novel I've been working on, it doesn't have any conflict in it, and they kept pushing me to put conflict in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a little girl, and it's about her teaching the world how to love again.
Mm-hmm. So, but there, I need to support that. I've read a lot about the art of writing and screenwriting, and if there's one rule is that there must, even though it's about some little girl who wants to make the world better, she needs to be placed in conflictual situations where she is having a difficult time. Because if she simply gives a lecture about, the importance of peace and love and the spirit or God, etc., nobody's going to read. It's boring. But if you put her, let's say, in a series of challenges where she's got, let's say, a mother who is somebody who doesn't care about making the world better and is stopping her at every turn, and then she triumphs over her mother, and then she gets beaten. Then she's got some very dishonest friend who goes and is ripping off 7-Elevens all the time, and how she dealt with that. Those are conflicts, and it is Aristotle wrote a book called Poetics, and Poetics is about the art of creating great dramas, great books, great plays. And this is not the only model that exists, but that one of the most time-honored, successful models of writing something that's going to get people to read it is where you take a normal, ordinary person, you start the book by just kind of explaining what her life is like in quiescence, in her normal state, so you can relate to her. She's the everyone, every woman, every man, every girl. And then something really big happens to her. It's called the inciting event, where something disrupts her quiescence, something either she loses her father or her mother, or she sees something horrible happen or whatever, and that puts her on its mission, a mission to go and try to bring spiritual excellence to the world, whatever it is. And then she faces a series of ever-rising challenges in her efforts to bring spirituality to the world, which she conquers each of them after tremendous, ever greater struggles. And then in the end, she's in the final confrontation where it is the seeming like the most difficult challenge she could face, and she either succeeds or fails. If she succeeds, it's considered a comedy in the Aristotelian sense. If she fails, it's considered a tragedy. So, but you see how conflict is critical to that, and without it, it becomes boring and nobody wants to read it. Does that make sense?
It really does. It really does.
Okay. I will leave you with that, and I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you so much.
All right, you take care. We are talking about career help, and you can see the career help can vary so much. Here I was essentially giving a lesson on the art of writing books or plays. Who would have thought that I would have invoked Aristotle's poetics? But you never know where help will come from. We take it wherever it can emerge. So if you would like me to provide some help for you to help you emerge from your stuckness in career, self-employment, I welcome your call for a 3-minute career makeover here on Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Marty Nemko, Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hello.
I'm wondering how to structure my day. I have a number of meetings I have to go to, a lot of them virtual, and I also have to close issues in a piece of software. I have to track other people's issues. I have to write some documents. I have to do a number of things. And sometimes it's very difficult to say, which one should I start with? Can I do a piece of one in between meetings? Mm-hmm. And I end up not doing as much as I would like.
If you're somebody who is motivated primarily by fun, but you have been ending up doing what you feel is most urgent, sometimes the way to get more done is to say, what's more fun? I'm going to do that first. If you're the other way around, if you're somebody who's always doing what's fun, but therefore the high priority things, tasks are not getting done, then maybe you need to work on priority based on what's important. Are you more fun-centric, or are you more work productivity, get-it-done-centric?
The latter, the getting done.
Okay. And so if I said that, you know, in an attempt to strike the golden mean and move to some more balance, if I said you would get more done and feel better about yourself and your life if you sometimes at least asked yourself, as you looked at that massive list, what's most fun? And either do the most fun thing first, or say, oh, I'm going to do this crap work first, but then I can look forward to the fun part. Is there any value in that particular set of advice, or is that off point, honestly?
I think part of it is I don't necessarily have control over what is the priority. The priorities are kind of handed down more than anything else. But within that handing down, there is a certain independence of my own to decide which one I do first, et cetera. As long as I meet the deadlines, they don't really care.
Do you think that, but is that suggestion within the constraints of the work that you have some control over, do you believe that either, you know, incorporating that fun concept, in other words, not just which is more fun, but how could I do this task in a fun way, would that enable you to get more done and feel better, or is that suggestion beside the point, I need to come up with some other suggestion for you?
I like the fact to try to make it more fun. I think that would be good, although it's kind of hard to think what that would be, but maybe that's what I need to do. I need to do some thinking along those lines.
Well, sometimes, for example, let's say you've got to run meetings. You know, there is a more fun and less fun way to run a meeting. You know, one of the ways my wife makes meetings fun is she loves to bake brownies or whatever and bring them in. Food is the lubricant of conversation. So that sets the tone for her meetings, which is really good. She's very informal and playful by nature, even though she's very smart and very, you know, she knows exactly what she's doing. But she just makes a point of making meetings fun so people don't hate her meetings. Similarly, if you've got a clear software, let's say problems and dilemmas, you know, I'll give you an example. I had a problem with my credit card today. There was a merchant was compromised. I had to change numbers. So I call the guy, and like, here it is. It's 8 in the morning on Sunday morning, and I'm half awake, and I'm having to deal with crap like, you know, getting a new credit card number. And the guy on the other end of the line was just playful. He sounded like your friendly bartender, and he just made it a pleasurable experience. So is there a way in which you could make your attitude more playful, even in the way you're doing what seemingly joyless tasks like closing software problems?
Yes, I think so. I think if I just stop thinking about, oh, what would happen if I didn't get anything done? What will happen if I get laid off? All those sort of anxieties. If I can put those aside, I think it would be easier to deal with.
Well, that is one of the oldest, and now I'm going to invoke the Buddhist tradition. It is so often said, but it is true, that being in the moment is everything. In the end, we're all going to die. So looking ahead to the bad, when we all are at risk of losing our jobs, of losing our health, of losing our spouse, of losing all kinds of crap that can happen. But if, you know, in the end, if you focus on the future, you're almost inevitably going to make yourself depressed. So I have a tendency to mild depression. But what I do all the time is when I start to feel the first nanosecond, I start to feel the woe is me. Oh, my God, I've got a doctor's checkup a month from now. What if he finds some unexpected, horrible thing, which I can go there? I mean, that's my mind tends to go to worry by nature. I stay in the moment. I say no. Right now, I'm having the privilege of talking with you here on KALW, and all of my energy is focused on you and our connection right here. If you stayed in the moment more and not worried about losing the job, to what extent, honestly, do you think that would help you?
Oh, I think I love that. I love that.
Okay. Well, I'll quit while I'm ahead. I wish you staying in the moment, and I wish you more fun. Because you sound like somebody who's, just your voice, sounds like you're wearing the weight of the world on your shoulders. Is that really?
Thanks so much.
Is that who you are?
Kind of, yeah. But I like that. I think day by day or moment by moment.
Moment by. Even if I had stage 4 cancer and I was facing death, the way to live life is to squeeze as much love and joy and contribution as you can out of that moment, even if you're facing stage 4 cancer. My dear friend Chris Chapman, the finest actor I've ever had the privilege to work with, just died 2 days ago, and yet he was in a play in which I directed, and he managed to extract pure pleasure out of every one of those moments, and he had stage 4 cancer, and he was on that stage with me. If he can do it, you and I can both do it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. I'll give out the phone number one more time. If you want some career help, practical or psychological, it really can cross there are no boundaries that are unacceptable. Anything related to your work life, directly or indirectly, I can almost always at least give you a baby step in the right direction, maybe even a major change. 415-841-4134. Let me give another tip, career tip, and then I'll go back to the phones. There is this guy named John Gottman, who is one of the most eminent marriage counselors in the world. And he has I forgot the name of the book, but some great book out. And one line in that book has transformed the way in which I interact with people, not just my wife, but everybody. And the concept is this, that every time you say something, it should, as often as possible, what is called move toward the person rather than move away from the person. I'll give you the best way to explain it by examples. If you, for example, somebody says something and you ask a clarifying question, that's moving toward them. It's building on what they say. If you give an example that supports what they say, let's say, I believe in this because of that, and you say, oh yeah, I do too because of blah, that's a moving toward, you're moving toward the person. Even a playful teasing. When you only playfully tease people you really like. So if you're kind of making a little playful tease to somebody else, that's moving toward them. Moving away is when you say yes, but. That's moving away. Yes, there are times you want to say yes, but do it consciously. Realize you pay a price in terms of the relationship every time you make a moving away statement. Every time you're just blathering about how great you are. Even if you're not putting the other person down, contrast, you're making the other person feel less, and that's a moving away statement. So that, to me, is a great one-liner for building connection. Your responses should move toward the person. And now let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Hello.
Hello?
Hi. Yes. What's on your mind?
Am I on the air? I'm not sure.
Yes, you are.
Fantastic. Sorry, I can't tell. So, I've been teaching for the last 14 years, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to make a career change.
Mm-hmm.
A little background knowledge. I actually lived in Japan for 8 years as a monk, and I was a professor over there as well. Mm. I've been back in America for the last 5 years, and some of my training that I've learned overseas back here doesn't necessarily fit into some of the society's, you know, beliefs and work ethics anymore. And I'm the other side of looking for a job is I want to make some money now. Mm-hmm. As, you know, teachers just don't do it anymore. They don't make enough money. So I'm kind of stuck in, like, how to go about looking for a job and basically finding something that's going to benefit, you know, how can I help other people? I've always been in the service industry helping other people.
Okay, let me ask you a few questions. You said you were teaching for 14 years. Well, in, for example, the San Francisco Unified School District, a teacher who's been teaching 14 years would make about $70,000, something like that, plus full benefits and summers off, etc. You're saying you want to make money and teaching won't do it. Are you aspiring to significantly more than $70,000 with full benefits and summers off?
Yeah, in terms of, I have a master's degree in ed, and I have 5 years of experience here in America. So the 14 years, the other 8 years was actually overseas.
What I'm saying is, you're saying teaching money won't do it for you. Are you saying that you're aspiring to a career that's going to pay significantly more than $70,000 a year plus benefits?
Yes, that's right. I'm looking at 3 figures, easy.
Okay. So let me ask a few more questions. You said you were a professor in Japan. We were a professor of what?
Ethics and bioethics, and also teaching college writing.
Okay. And you said you kind of implied that your values were very important. You said your values were not traditionally what are American. Tell me, what are the critical values that you hold?
Well, I'm very nonsensical. If I see something that I feel is off, I'll just kind of say that. And it's not from a place of, you know, ego or a place of self-righteousness. It's just like that action is not necessarily appropriate.
So,
a little bit more direct on the from the East Coast side compared to the West Coast. West Coast is a little bit more softer, where you kind of have to hug a little bit more, for lack of a better word.
Okay, so to what extent do you, when you were teaching bioethics and ethics, to what extent do you want to make simply ethics, you know, you can make ethics a part of any job, whether you're a plumber or you're a professor, but some people try to make a living as bioethicists. I had one on the show, a bioethicist. To what extent did you want to make your ethics a part, core to the actual career you're going to pursue?
It's the foundation, it's the structure in which I live, so it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, my main income, because I'm pretty much at this point non-corruptible in terms of, like, losing my ethics, so it doesn't have to be the forefront of my career.
We only have a few seconds. How's your, just give me very short answers, how is your Japanese?
Average.
People who make 6 figures, I'm going to mention 5 or 6 careers that earn 6 figures. You tell me which is closest to you. Lawyers, doctors, business executives, directors of fundraising for a nonprofit, small business owners. Which do you see yourself being most likely?
Business.
Small business owner. So,
not small business, just regular.
Okay. And if you, in order, given your unusual background, it sounds like you may have to go back and get an MBA. So I wish I had more time. I'm not sure I'm right about that, but I have to say goodbye. What I would encourage you to do is to look at the bios of people who are business executives on LinkedIn. Look at what they've done and see if that offers a suggestion for you. Sorry I couldn't give you more time. I gave you to the last second. Thanks very much for calling Work with Marty. Okay. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on callers and talk with Kurt Thomas of Thomas Farms on what it's really like to be an organic farmer. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.